Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Sean Dugan of Channel 11 News, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, their veteran columnist. Governor Sean Parnell vetoes some $400 million worth of capital projects. We've been waiting quite a while for this, Steve, the number of weeks. Tell us about the vetoes.
Well, it started off with the legislature passing a $3.2 billion capital improvement or capital project budget, and the governor whittled it down, as you said, Michael, by $400 million. So it stands at $2.8 billion. One of the big worries during the legislative session by members of the state Senate was that the governor would go deeply into the energy projects that the senators had passed and carve them out of the bill if he was going to veto anything. I think the governor was pretty even-handed, I think, in what he did. He did cut a $10 million appropriation that would have helped construct a natural gas pipeline from Anchor Point into Homer. He did cut that.
That is Gary Stevens' district. Some people notice that.
It is. It is. He cut $25 million from a $125 million appropriation to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation that would have funded more home rebates and weatherization. He also cut $30 million, he also approved $66 million for the Susitna Hydro Project, approved $25 million for the Sitka Blue Lake Hydro Project, and also approved a $10 million appropriation for a wind farm for Golden Valley Electric. So there were energy projects that certainly did get approval, and there were some that were pared down, and there were some that were eliminated altogether.
And it's quite a lot of money, no matter how you look at it.
That's true.
Sean Dugan, how did Anchorage fare, and do we know where the $400 million figure came from?
Well, the $400 million, he's been saying all along that he was going to make significant cuts, and in part, he said, because the legislature did not pass his proposed oil tax changes, he said that that was the impetus for him making significant cuts. History will be the judge of why those cuts were made and where they were made. But if you at least talk to the Anchorage mayor, Anchorage did fairly well. Obviously, there were some cuts made to the port of Anchorage. That's a project, though, that has been mired in controversy and problems throughout its history. Some of the big things also cut in Anchorage, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, long-term care facility, $20 million. The football stadium was another $1.5 million. And the school district had some cuts, $4 million for roof replacements. $7.5 million was vetoed from the port, and the blood bank did not get $2 million that they were asking for. So I think overall Anchorage did well. Maybe some Anchorage senators, certain ones, Democrat Hall's French most notably, might disagree with that, claiming that 70% of the things in his district were vetoed. But it seems that the Anchorage vetoes, at least from looking at it, follow along pretty well with the ones made everywhere else.
Yeah, it seems like the governor's a sports fan too. $34 million were in the budget. Was in the budget for finishing off the planning and the architecture and the construction of a sports arena for UAA. This is something that the university here in Anchorage has wanted badly for many years, they got that money. So that project is definitely a go ahead. And then he approved also, I think, a couple of million dollars, $2 million, to help promote the Great Alaska Shootout and lure up better teams to play in that tournament. You know, if you're a basketball fan, you know that tournament's been kind of wobbly over the last couple of years.
It's a wonderful tournament, but it's kind of hard for me to figure out how that's a capital expenditure.
Yeah, I don't know either, but it is, I guess.
Improve attendance.
I guess so. It's an improve. Yeah, we'll improve the
Okay, let's get Dermot Cole in here. Dermot, thank you for joining us. How did Fairbanks do in the capital budget? What are people saying up there?
Well, I think the main reaction is that the governor sort of spread out his vetoes. Most of what was in the budget for the Fairbanks area was approved. In other words, not vetoed. The key vetoes here were $6 million to replace the roof or to fix the roof of the public library here, and also he cut about half of the bonding authority that the University of Alaska Fairbanks wanted to use. So that was a $33.5 million cut. But that's the sort of cut that most people are not really going to notice. The largest project in this area is this Tanana River Railroad Bridge, which included $44 million on top of a similar amount approved last year.
That's big money, all right. Okay, was there any evidence up there of retaliation as well? This is something that people have talked about down here, especially Democrats.
Well, I know that Representative Beth Curtula has said that the governor really went after projects supported by Bert Stedman and Lyman Hoffman. And here, in particular, one project favored by Senator Joe Pascavan was vetoed, and that was to set up a mentoring program called the Friends of Children. But I think beyond that, it's hard to see any retaliation, if indeed that was retaliation.
Yeah, and the governor's not going to say, I'm only vetoing projects of people who supported me, not people who were on the other side. Steve McDonald, very briefly.
Just in Anchorage, too, you know, Dermot points out what was being said down in Juneau about, Southwest Alaska. In Anchorage here, you had Lindsay Holmes, representative in West Anchorage. You had Hollis French, who's the senator out there in West Anchorage. They were complaining that about 70% of their projects had been cut. And they, of course, opposed the governor's proposed change in the oil taxes during the session. So they felt they were being retaliated against here in Anchorage. So that was the Anchorage version of things.
Thank you, Steve. The Coastal Zone Management Program dies in a special session of the legislature. Sean Dugan, make sense of this for us. Why does the legislature go to Juneau for a special session to kill a bill?
Well, I think it would take more than the half an hour we have to make sense of that. But from everything I've seen, the legislature, when they actually finally, after weeks and weeks of going back and forth of whether they were going to have the support to go back to Juneau, they finally seemed to have some kind of agreement in place between the House and Senate after about a week of really hard negotiations at the Anchorage LIO office between leadership. They went down there and something happened with the House. The Senate passed it, but the House took a step back, and some are suggesting that would be Governor Sean Parnell's intervention, telling people that he believed, and he has said this himself at least, that he believed that by reauthorizing it after it had already been staffed down, the employees had left, that it would jeopardize specifically some mining projects that were up for this summer because they would not be able to get the permits they needed, and it would cost jobs. There's some debate as to whether that's the case. There's a 90-day rule that was brought up by Senator Bill Willikowski that he claims if within 90 days your permit has not been looked at, then it's automatically approved. But it's very curious, especially since the governor knew when the legislature was going down at least a week before, 5 or 6 days, that he came out with opposition right before the House and Senate were going to vote on the bill. And
well, he said, I'll veto it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this is pretty unusual, I think.
And I would agree with you. We've asked the question, why didn't you tell them this before they went down to Juneau and spent $30,000 a day?
It was about 60 or so, I think.
60.
Maybe more than that.
Yeah, and it'll probably end up being more than that, but why wouldn't you tell them that before they make the agreement? And he said, well, they should have known, basically, was his answer, that he has said all along that he said as late as the week before that the program was unsavable, unsalvageable.
Okay. I went to see Governor Parnell before the Resource Development Council this weekend. It was a huge crowd, and he gave a speech, a brief one, on the Coastal Zone program and his view. First of all, he said, gave us the I'm a reasonable person. Then he said, it's all the Senate's fault. Then he said, I'm not sure it would have made any difference anyway. Dermot, what is this all about?
Well, part of it, Mike, I think, is the continuing gulf between the governor and the Senate. And I think this is sort of it looks to me like this is sort of a hangover from the fight over oil taxes, which is sort of taken a break right now, but will resume in force in January. It's hard to imagine why the legislature would ever go into special session to not do something. You know, it's kind of a difficult thing to fathom. Part of it, however, may be that the opposition to the plan that came from industry really gathered steam as soon as the legislature decided to go back.
Steve McDonald, I keep hearing the word dysfunctional from people who are involved in politics to describe what happened in Juneau in the last few days, especially those who want to be critical of the governor. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have had legislative special sessions. I remember at least one on subsistence. There may have been several, and maybe others here remember more, mm-hmm. Where they went down there and didn't pass a bill. But those were, how would I put it? They were issues that involved huge constituencies,
yeah,
with something that had been on the front burner for a long
time. For a long time, yes.
So this was unusual, no?
Yeah, I think it was. They had an opportunity to deal with this during the regular session. It's hard to craft good legislation when you have a proverbial gun at your head, and that's what they had. They had a July 1st deadline where this program was just going to go away completely, right? They were going to extend this program. Most of the people, the vast majority of the people who worked in this organization to make this coastal zone management program work had already left. I mean, they're off trying to find other jobs. So even if they had approved it and extended the deadline, there was really nobody in that office that could do the work
right
that they did before. So it was like herding cats to get people down there. The governor then throws a bucket of cold water on it when, as Sean pointed out, said he'd veto it. It just seemed very dysfunctional. They should have done this during the legislative session when they had more time to get more input.
And several members were in Europe.
Several members were in Europe. Yeah, that's another thing. Their people are traveling. So
this originally started out, at least the divide started out over the language of who are you going to believe, science or local knowledge. I seem to remember that being the sticking point between specifically the House and the Senate. Are you going to give more credence to the local knowledge of that coastal area? Are you going to give more credence to scientists? And one of the arguments was that much of the research and many of the scientists would not be familiar with the specifics of that local area. And it seems, I would agree with Dermot, that it seems to be, I think it's a good use of the term, a hangover from the regular session, and even the first special session as well.
Dealing with oil taxes and ACEs.
And, you know, oil taxes weren't a part of that first special session, but they certainly colored it.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey, and I'm here with Steve McDonald, Sean Dugan, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole. Anchorage Superintendent of Schools Carol Como announces her retirement 1 year from now. Steve, why is she going, and do we know anything about the search?
Well, that's something that the school board is going to take on, the search. They'll do a national search. They'll also look within to see if there's someone within the district who wants to take this job. Whoever gets this job, huge shoes to fill. Carol Como, when she finally leaves the district, will have served 12 years as its superintendent. And I'll tell you right straight up front, I am a Carol Como fan. I think she's done a great job, and I think she epitomizes what a leader is.
And it's the longest-serving school.
Longest-serving. She took a district that was, we'll use the word from the last topic, somewhat dysfunctional. The superintendent preceded her gave the district one-day notice and then announced his resignation and left. She was named interim. She held that post for a couple of months, and then in December of 1999, the board gave her the gig permanently, and she's worked it since then. You asked why. She's never tell a woman's age, I guess, but she's up there, like about 70 years old. You would never know it to look at her or to see the amount of energy she has.
What school of diplomacy did you attend?
None whatsoever. Now I'm going to get a beating from Carol when I say that. But I just say I marvel at her energy. I marvel at what she does. She seems to be everywhere. She has grandkids who live outside, and she wants to see her grandkids. And it's hard to plan those trips. She told me it's hard to plan the trips when you've got to deal with the legislature, you've got to deal with the assembly, you've got to deal with the school board, she's constantly in constant demand. She tries to be at every school district function she possibly can be. You know, she hands out diplomas to every single yep. high school kid who graduates.
That's one of the more remarkable things. I've seen some of that.
Yeah, attends concerts and choral groups, and she's there for everything. If I could say one more thing, you may not like her straight ahead style. She is very plain spoken. She is very direct. You may not like that, but and you may not like the fact there are people who just say, oh, the school budget is way too high and not enough of the money gets into the classroom. Fine, that's a valid point. You know, you can debate that. But she is what I think every politician should strive to be, and that is that she was hands-on, she was responsible, and she stood in there and took the lumps, but she answered the questions and was always available to the media. And like I said, they got a year to come up with somebody pretty good, and it's a big shoes to fill.
Sean Dugan, your thoughts on Carol Como?
Well, I would agree with Steve. I, too, am a big Carol Como fan, at least in the way she has engaged the community. As Steve said, you know, she does have her detractors, and maybe some of that criticism is fair criticism, but... you know, I know that you too have probably talked to her on a cell phone when she's in the lower 48 doing something else. She
That's
was
right.
always available. 2 o'clock in the morning, you could call her up if there was a teacher negotiation that had something break, and she would answer the phone. She'd come down. She'd be live on the air in the morning. I've never known another school district superintendent in any of the markets I've worked in. There was that available, and I think she really did become the face of the Anchorage School District.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it.
And her energy level, if we could tap that, we wouldn't have an energy problem in Cook Inlet.
And they're really, for somebody who has been as successful and popular and beloved as Carol Como, there's really no good time to leave because your fans and the public are going to say, give us more.
They are, but I think, you know, maybe it is a good time for her to leave. You gotta find somebody. She can't be there forever. And, you know, that district is not getting any easier to run, and not for nothing, but teacher negotiations are coming up again, and I wonder how a new superintendent might play into that.
Okay. Dermot Cole, there have been a couple of news stories. I read one yesterday and one today. Ali Eske has done a study of the question of throughput of the Trans-Alaska pipeline and concerns about the flow and concerns about the health of the pipeline. It's quite a study. What can you tell us?
Well, Mike, this is an important study, and it is really a big issue for Alaska. As oil flow in the pipeline continues to decline, we're getting more and more operational problems in the winter. And that's because the oil includes a lot of things that settle out of it as cold weather descends and the temperature of the oil drops. The temperature of the oil is dropping because there's less of it flowing through the pipeline. So ice tends to form, wax buildup becomes more of a problem, and there are various other operational challenges. This study found that several new techniques are going to be needed to keep the pipeline flowing at the rates that are expected in the next few years. The oil company spent about $10 million on this study, and they said that the pipeline could be operated safely down to about 350,000 barrels a day, but only if several steps are taken to deal with cold weather.
Okay. Thank you very much. We see, Steve, you want to jump in here?
No, I think Dermot covered it just fine, yeah.
Okay, fine. We see political polls all the time in our business. They're quite common. But here's one that's quite surprising. Mike Picaro, the radio personality, radio leader, and also a involved in consulting, has a poll that shows if the presidential election were held today in Alaska, Barack Obama would defeat Sarah Palin. This is quite a surprise. Sean, what are the numbers and what do you make of this?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't personally put too much in polls. We've all seen some polls, especially Alaska polls and local polls, that have really been kind of upside down when it came time to vote. But at least according to the numbers of this poll, Obama would edge out Governor Palin by 9 points in a hypothetical matchup. 500 Alaskans polled, 16% remain undecided, and only 7% say that they would be supporting someone else. So I think the one thing that comes out of this is just affirmation that when it comes to Sarah Palin, most people have made up their minds, I think.
You know, I was thinking about this too. Given our experience with politics, the Democratic vote for anybody for president is about 38%.
Right.
And so it probably is not too surprising that, you know, you could get it up to 45% or 44 or whatever we saw in these numbers. That isn't particularly surprising. I guess that just the general impression that Sarah Palin isn't as popular here as some people might think she is.
Well, and previous polls have borne that out, actually. Mm-hmm. But again, statistics are statistics, and they can be made. A lot could happen as well between now and the election.
This leads us to a question that we've examined before, but once again, Steve McDonald, does Sarah Palin have a political future here, or is it all elsewhere, if anywhere?
I think it's all elsewhere at this particular point in time. What that would be, I don't know. I don't think she could come back here and, say, run for governor again and get her old job back. I just don't think that could happen. Obviously, I don't know if this is a referendum on Obama's performance as president or Palin's performance as former governor or whatever.
Oh, there'd be some people who would probably respond, do I have to vote?
Yeah, I have to vote, right. It's like a Louisiana election. And she's obviously a very polarizing person. But then again, think back 3 years ago. We were talking, a lot of folks thought that President, then Senator Obama, was going to win Alaska. And if that would have happened, he'd have been the first Democratic presidential candidate since Lyndon Johnson in 1964 to do that. Lyndon Johnson's the only candidate, only Democratic candidate to win Alaska. There were polls that showed him, a lot of different polls that showed him leading in Alaska. Then Senator McCain goes off and gets Sarah Palin, and that was the end of that. So the Republicans carried the state. This time around, obviously, feelings are quite a bit different. But I'm like Sean, too. So many things can happen. If she decides that she's going to run, that may just re-energize her base up here.
And look at what happened to Michelle Bachmann. She was polling in the single digits until she did her big rollout, and then all of a sudden she's the front runner, at least in the polls. So, I mean, these things ebb and they flow. You know, there's also the argument that a lot of polls undercount very conservative voters, that they just don't answer the polls. So, you know, it's interesting.
It is. I think that you did a very nice job, because it is interesting. But if people were actually going into a ballot booth, I think most people who have experienced Alaska would say, don't bet on it.
No, not. I wouldn't bet on the Democrat taking Alaska.
Yeah. And then there'd be a campaign. That's the other thing that we're completely forgetting here. Okay, Dermot, on the question of Sarah Palin, is this poll notwithstanding, is her career as a political leader over or ending, has she entered the world of where she's purely a celebrity, or does she have political opportunities remaining?
Well, Mike, it's as we've been speculating for months, maybe for the past few years, as to what the future holds for Sarah Palin. And I think she's proven to be the most popular celebrity from Alaska, and probably also the most unpopular celebrity from Alaska. At the same time, I don't know if she's going to run for president or not. She has managed to sort of keep the nation guessing, and that's probably keeps her in the headlines and keeps her being talked about. She may very well run, even though lots of people are saying she won't. I think she's kind of in an unpredictable stage, I could make an argument either way, why she would run or why she would not run.
Well, and this is part of her success has been keep them guessing.
Well, that's true. That's the focus of every story we see. You know, will she or won't she, or does she or doesn't she? You know, I mean, it's quite. You have to marvel at her ability to capture the nation's attention. That's all I can
say. She does have a genius for that. Sean Dugan, the USGS boosts inlet gas estimates, and this could make a big difference for Anchorage if this proves to be true. Tell us about that.
Well, that's an interesting study. You know, it's one of those things where looking out, it looks like there's a lot of gas in Cook Inlet. The last one they did was in, 1995. They said there were 2.14 trillion cubic feet of gas. This one is a significant increase, 19 trillion cubic feet of gas and 600 million barrels of oil. As well as 46 million barrels of natural gas liquids, most of it easy to get to, according to the USGS. We saw maybe an indication that the oil companies believe that as well in the recent state lease sale in Cook Inlet. They had the most leases they've had in quite a while. I think they had 155 bids. Most of them were taken up by one company. That's the other angle here, is that the smaller companies, the wildcatters, are starting to come back. But, you know, The federal government recently canceled a lease sale in Cook Inlet for lack of interest. And until such time as somebody puts a hole.
Yeah, if I might ask, I mean, the question here would be, it seems to me, that okay, there's a lot of gas, but is it available at what price?
Well, and that's the big question. With the market we have in Alaska, they always tell us that we need to export. We don't have the population and this commercial demand to make these things profitable. The other part of this is, so there's a lot of gas there. Even if they started drilling now, we're talking about importing LNG into Anchorage to supply us with energy, because nothing would be online for, 10 years at least, if they drilled today.
Okay, thank you very much. Sean, we're going to stick with you. We've got about 1 minute left, and I want to get in something that was sort of sandwiched last week, and that was the Amber Alert we had here that raised questions about the whole system.
Yeah, that's interesting. The State Department of Homeland Security, which is now in charge of the Amber Alert and the tsunami warning alerts, they're all on the same system, says that they actually go through Fairbanks. You may remember Governor Murkowski got rid of the Anchorage Trooper Dispatch Station. So there were some problems. The Amber Alert, there was some confusion over whether the young lady was under 18 or over 18.
This has to do with an abduction or alleged abduction.
The first, it was an alleged abduction, but the way it went out, it was choppy on some stations. The same thing happened the very next day with this, or the day after that, I believe, 2 days later, with the tsunami alert that went out, and the sound quality sounded like it had been recorded by Thomas Edison himself with Watson in the other room. You know, this is 2011. I think that the sound quality at least shouldn't sound like it was done on the surface of the moon.
The sound quality of our show is we're out of time. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.